So I'm in the car the other day, I put the radio on, and what song happens to come on? But what you're about to hear, this right here, in honor of Daniel Bryan being out of the WWE title picture and moved back down the card, should be his new theme music going forward. I give to you Daniel Bryan's new theme song. Listen to those lyrics. How perfect is that? I fight authority. Authority always wins. The Authority song by John Mellencamp. It's just complete happenstance. I happen to be in the car. That song came on in a week where Daniel Bryan is no longer in the title picture. And I thought to myself, this has to be his new entrance theme. They've got to somehow get the rights to this song because it's just perfect. This is episode 299. Of the Solomonster Sounds Off podcast here exclusively on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes. It is Sunday, November 3rd, 2013. I am the Solomonster. We're going to talk about Daniel Bryan in just a moment. Also, Taz makes a shocking admission this week. Okay, so it's not so shocking. It's something we already knew, but it was still shocking to hear him say it on TNA television. We'll get to that later in the Impact review. A show that I actually really enjoyed. Plus some breaking news on what celebrity was in Nashville this past week about possibly buying a stake in Impact Wrestling. I also want to address a rumor about Hulk Hogan that originated on the website examiner.com in the last few days. The story that popped up that he hasn't signed a contract officially, but he has made some sort of verbal commitment to return to WWE. I don't put much stock in stories that originate on examiner.com, so take it with a grain of salt. I've read nothing on any sort of reliable site that backs it up. So right now, nothing more than a rumor. Hogan may well end up back in WWE. In fact, I think there's a pretty good chance he will. And if he does, believe me, the Examiner will not be the website that breaks that news. And this notion in the report, if you read it, that he would return as some surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble, which he would either have to win or would have to be dumped out over the top rope, it's just completely laughable to me. So don't put much stock into those reports right now. Hogan may end up back there, but there is nothing new to report on that front as of right now. You can make a PayPal donation to the show. Go on thesolomonster.com, scroll down a little bit. You'll see a little PayPal donate box on the right-hand side. I want to say thank you to Hunter Palmer, who made a donation to the show this week. We are, of course, heading into our six-year anniversary next Sunday, which also happens to be episode 300 of The Sound Off. So I can't think of a better time to make a PayPal donation. Maybe I can get 300 PayPal donations between now and next Sunday. You never know. But go there if you want to make a donation. I do appreciate all the support. Also, for those of you who are interested in my Sound Off extras and who are not aware of it, there is a new video up on our official YouTube channel. You can search The Solomonster on YouTube and subscribe to us there. A full 36-minute review of last Sunday's WWE Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, which I thought was just an average show. It peaked with the opening match, that tag team title three-way with the Rhodes Brothers, the Usos, and the Shield. Those guys work tremendously well together. So that was a pleasure. That was great. That was the best part of the entire show. And it went steadily downhill from there. This show also made it painfully obvious, again, that there is no real point in having the Hell in a Cell when they have a lot of these main event matches. They had two cell matches on that pay-per-view last weekend. Punk against Ryback, which turned out to be a singles match because Paul Heyman never set foot inside the cage. And Daniel Bryan, Randy Orton in the main event with Shawn Michaels as the guest referee. They did the big climactic finish. I would call it an anticlimactic finish where Michaels kicks Bryan in the face. Orton gets the pin. The cell structure never really came into play in any of those matches. The biggest thing they did was have Punk climb on top after his match was already over and beat up Paul Heyman. It made, I guess, for kind of a cool visual, but no point at all in having the Hell in a Cell for either match, and they wonder why that gimmick doesn't sell the way that it used to. I've said it before. It's October. Time to bust out the cell. That's not why you should be using the Hell in a Cell. And at the end of the day, John Cena and Randy Orton leave as champions. So I guess what's old is new again. I also wanted to add one thing that I didn't mention in the video. This was Jim Ross. He commented on the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, and I just wanted to read this little snippet from his blog earlier in the week. He said, "I was expecting more, and I'm not sure exactly what, from the main event bout between Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton. The match never quite got over the hump for me. One certainly cannot slight the efforts of all involved. But sometimes the game plan looks better on paper than in actual execution. The key element to consider is that many consumers bought their second $50-plus dollar pay-per-view this month, and at some point the majority of the fan base, considering that they were pulling for Daniel Bryan, has to be made happy." So that's from Jim Ross earlier this week, and I think after Raw Monday night, the fan base pulling for Daniel Bryan, anything but happy. Let's get into Raw here. Episode 1066 from Orlando, Florida. The good, the bad, and the ugly here. John Cena made his first Raw appearance in, I guess, 2 months or so. It's been a while, not too long. And he was cutting a promo here at the beginning of the show and amping up the thug nature of his character. We, you know, we don't see John Cena go thug too often these days, but he was showing flashes of that here. And the big angle was Damian Sandow coming out, Mr. Money in the Bank, the biggest loser. Actually, I take that back. The second biggest loser on the WWE roster behind The Miz, the way he's been booked of late. We'll talk about him in a second. Sandow comes out, talks about cashing in. He teases it, and then he goes to walk away, and he ends up beating John Cena from behind. He smacks him with the briefcase. He beats him down. This is a pretty intense beatdown. He was going after Cena's bad arm. He wrapped it around the post. He took him outside and smashed a chair over his elbow. So he did all these different things to incapacitate John Cena, called the referee down, and in fact did finally cash in his Money in the Bank briefcase. And a lot of people are up in arms because he lost. After all these months and all the jobbing and everything else, there's no payoff for Damian Sandow. He beat down John Cena, he wrestled him in a pretty competitive match, and he lost 1-2-3 in the middle of the ring. Now, I called Sandow cashing in and losing months ago, but it should have been painfully obvious to anybody who's been paying any attention. Damian Sandow has been booked like a loser for months now. Ever since he won that briefcase, he has been just completely in a downward spiral. It's been poison. He's been carrying around a box of poison for months now. So him beating John Cena, who just came back, face of the company, new world champion, it's never going to happen. But what he did was he went in there, he had a hot match. I thought the opening to Raw, all the stuff they did here, I thought it was great. I thought it was one of the hottest openings to Raw they've done in a long time. He went in there, he looked about as strong as he could possibly look, considering that he lost to a one-armed man with a weak-looking fireman's carry. Even by attitude adjustment standards, again, the story of the match was he was hurt. This looked pretty bad. Considering all of that, I thought Sandow looked about as strong as they could possibly make him, despite the loss. Okay, it was a competitive match. Hopefully this is a turning point for the guy. If he shows up on television this week and continues losing matches, then this was all for nothing. And I take it all back. Okay, you can't squander a performance like this against the face of the company. You use it as a launching pad for bigger things. I thought the opening to the show was great. I really have nothing overly negative to say about it. I know that people are very upset that Cena had one arm and he still beat Sandow, but I can't see why people are so surprised by that. If you've been paying attention to the product for any length of time, this should not come as a shock to you. If anything, I'm surprised that he actually went in there and had as long and as competitive a match as he did. I thought it would be a one-and-done type of thing. Even with one arm, Cena would beat him in 3 minutes flat. I don't know the length of the match. I didn't time it, but it went on. I think it went through like two or three commercial breaks. Poor Damian Sandow is cashing in his briefcase, and they have to go to commercial. So the commercial break gives John Cena a chance to recover. That's not fair. But no, it went a couple of commercial breaks, and I thought it was maybe the best match Sandow has ever had in his entire run in WWE. So use it as a launching pad. Use it as a way to get people to take you seriously again, to get some wins under your belt, and who knows where he may end up. Dean Ambrose and Big E Langston had a match for the United States Championship, a rematch from the pay-per-view. They do that often. We had actually multiple rematches from Hell in a Cell on the show, including Punk and Ryback. This was one of them. The match ended very quickly by disqualification and then morphed into a six-man tag with Big E and the Usos who came out to save Big E from a post-match beatdown. They took on the Shield, six-man tag. Good match. Ended with Roman Reigns nailing both Usos with a double spear for the pin. What did I say earlier this year about Roman Reigns? WWE's next big babyface if they play their cards right. Very much like when Batista broke out of Evolution. In my mind, this is playing out in a very similar way. And sadly, it looks like the seeds are already being planted for an eventual Shield breakup. We had Dean Ambrose cutting a promo before his match with Big E, talking about how he was the only champion left in the Shield, and Roman Reigns kind of gave him a dirty look. And then later on during the main event segment, when Randy Orton was hugging Triple H and Stephanie, in the background you see the Shield all lined up, and you see Roman Reigns, he kind of had this disgusted expression on his face in the background, very subtle. I say sadly because I'm not really ready for these guys to break up yet. I mean, imagine how much worse Raw would be this year without those three guys. They have been the in-ring MVPs of this company in 2013, along with Daniel Bryan. Okay, got to give him credit too. This month marks 1 year since their debut, Survivor Series last year when they first came on the scene. They have been losing an awful lot lately, but for most of this year, they have been booked perfectly. I can't remember three new guys that WWE has brought up and booked as strongly as this trio and made stars out of them. They protected them. They gave them a unique entrance. They booked them with main eventers. They put them in long matches. They put them over more than they lost. And the fans still react when they come out like it's something special when they make their entrance. It's a blueprint for how to get guys over. You can't do it with everybody, obviously, but if they tried half as hard with the rest of the roster to get them over as they did with these three guys, they'd have a lot more legit stars than they do right now. Shawn Michaels was on this show to explain himself after super kicking his protege in the face at the pay-per-view. He invited Daniel Bryan to come out to hear his explanation and accept his apology. Shawn was getting a lot of heel heat here. He got a lot of "you sold out" chants. The people were firmly behind Daniel Bryan in this segment. And to me, that was telling because Shawn Michaels is one of those guys. You know, he's Teflon. He'll come out there. People don't want to boo Shawn Michaels. You know, he's this legendary figure. He's always there to have fun, and he's been retired now for, 4 years? He comes out. He's going to get a big reaction no matter what. This was the first time I can remember Shawn getting this kind of reaction, maybe since that little heel turn he had back in 05 when he went up against Hogan. You know, he's the kind of guy people don't want to boo, and yet it just goes to show you how invested in the Daniel Bryan character I think a lot of the audience is. Even if it isn't translating into numbers, which we'll get to, people, you know, they like Daniel Bryan. They want to see him succeed. They want to see him, you know, in the title picture. They want to see him overcome all the obstacles that are being put in front of him. And even now, even in this case, they're willing to go out there and boo Shawn Michaels and cheer Daniel Bryan. And that tells you something right there. So I was really taken by that people would just so quickly turn on Shawn Michaels just for super kicking, you know, this little B-plus troll, as they would call him, in the face the night before. People didn't like that. You know, people didn't want to see that, and they took it out on Shawn Michaels here. So Shawn, I thought, was excellent in this segment. He cut a great promo. He talked about how, listen, Triple H is my best friend. He's been there for me in my darkest of moments. He'll always be there for me. I'll always be there for him, no matter what. And he asked Daniel Bryan to understand and shake my hand. And Daniel Bryan would not do it. I like that at no point during this promo did Daniel Bryan speak. He just stood there with this really menacing, pissed-off look on his face, like he wanted to kill Michaels, which is exactly how he should have played it. I was hoping, you know, Bryan maybe would give Shawn a running knee, fix that lazy eye for him. When Bryan refused to shake Shawn's hand, Michaels cut a very heelish promo on him. I don't want to say he turned heel, but he definitely was heeling on Bryan here. He called him a self-righteous little puke. That's pretty heelish to me. He said, "I'm Shawn Michaels. You need to show me the respect I deserve by shaking my hand." He said, "Last night, after training you for years earlier, right, you finally learned your last lesson. And that is that WWE is a shark tank, and you don't trust anybody. Not even that future wife of yours," which I thought was an interesting comment for him to make. And Daniel Bryan ended up taking his advice, and he locked Shawn Michaels in the yes lock. Michaels flailed around like a fish and then started tapping like a madman. Referees had a run down, pull Bryan off Michaels. Interestingly, at no point during this did Triple H come out to save his friend, even though Shawn helped him the night before. He did him a solid. Triple H was nowhere to be found here. So I wonder how that plays into things going forward. Shawn Michaels keeps telling people he's retired. He's not wrestling another match. He's done. He's retired. But if he doesn't wrestle Bryan at WrestleMania, I could see him doing one final match against Triple H. I think those two guys would probably love to work a match against each other. I still say, though, a Shawn Michaels-Daniel Bryan match at WrestleMania 30, definitely best for business. I really liked the segment. I thought Bryan was good. I thought Michaels was great. And in the end, Daniel Bryan tapped out Shawn Michaels on live TV. I would hardly call that a burial. It's not as though Shawn would be willing to do that for just about anybody. You know, but he did it for Daniel Bryan. That means something. What came next, though, was disheartening. If you are a fan of Daniel Bryan, his work, his character, and if you followed what they've done with him since SummerSlam, you know, he beat John Cena for the WWE title, and then immediately lost the title to Randy Orton on a pedigree from Triple H. The next night on Raw, he should have come out like a crazy man and gone after Triple H. Instead, he gets left laying. He then gets left laying to end the next 8 straight shows, I think it was, before finally getting one over on the Authority. He won at Night of Champions, but not really, because they told us he only won because of the fast count by a crooked referee, and they stripped him of the championship. He got knocked out by Big Show at Battle Point. I've merged Battleground and Breaking Point for Battle Point. That could be a new pay-per-view next year. No, but he got knocked out by Big Show at Battleground. That's what I was getting at there. And then Hell in a Cell, he loses to Randy Orton after being kicked in the face by one of his trainers, who's been retired for over 3 years. So it's great of Shawn Michaels to tap out to the guy on TV, but unless they're building to a match between the two, I think it may be too little too late for some fans. You know, which leads me to WWE's quarterly earnings call this week, which was held on Halloween. Quite appropriate given some of the scary pay-per-view numbers they revealed. We found out that the total number of worldwide buys on pay-per-view were 199,000 for Money in the Bank, which was actually up from 188 last year, 296,000 for SummerSlam, which was down pretty significantly from 350 last August, and 175,000 for Night of Champions, down from 189 the previous year. The SummerSlam number is the key one. Vince McMahon on the call said pay-per-view is an attraction-driven business. He said SummerSlam was not the right attraction. You don't knock them all out of the park. That one was a swing and a miss. And I think we all know who's getting the blame for that one. The Miz. He should anyway. He hosted this year's SummerSlam. It's all his fault. Rock hosted WrestleMania. They did over 1 million buys. I can't imagine why The Miz couldn't do the same thing. No, it's Daniel Bryan, which would explain the way they've booked him of late. I just find this all so depressing. I was genuinely excited about SummerSlam this year. I thought they did a hell of a job promoting those two top matches, Cena vs. Bryan, Punk vs. Lesnar, and Cena vs. Bryan was a fresh match that we have never seen before on pay-per-view. Finally, it was somebody different, challenging for the world championship in the main event, and with Punk vs. Lesnar, that was the real attraction of that pay-per-view. I don't know if that's what Vince was referring to when he said that, you know, when he said it wasn't the right attraction, but it's not like Brock or Punk is going to take the blame for this. They're made men. Daniel Bryan is not. I go back to Jim Ross. You can tell I'm way more fascinated in reading his blogs now that he's out of the WWE bubble. He had this to say after listening to the conference call during the week. He said executives were apparently disappointed with the SummerSlam buy rate and the term attraction was used as the reason. Could not agree more. Pay-per-views are all attraction-driven and always have been. However, the more that is given away for free on TV, and the more free TV that is provided, the harder it is for attractions to be considered worth spending extra money on. I'm a believer that TV ratings can be achieved without giving away multiple pay-per-view attractions, but only if long-term creative planning is firmly in place. Changing things on the fly and making 11th-hour decisions regarding direction will never be a successful formula. How some in the business can discount the lack of disposable income for the average Joe to buy monthly pay-per-views is beyond me. Plus, what new talent in the business today is truly hot? Until someone new gets hot and connects organically with the audience, then the shift in the perception of the genre is not likely to change anytime soon. I agree with everything he's saying here, but Daniel Bryan did connect organically with the audience in a way that nobody else has in this company in years. Okay, find me another person who connected the way that he did with the crowd, despite the way he was booked and doing the mid-card comedy bullshit Find me one other person who connected with the audience the way that this guy did in the last 5 or 6 years. Okay, and whether they intended to or not, they put their creative to work on the guy, and what they did is they found a creative way to kill his momentum. So I agree with him up to a point, but this notion that, you know, until somebody can connect organically, I mean, unless he's looking for the next Steve Austin, who's not out there, by the way. I don't see the new Steve Austin anywhere, or the next Rock. Okay, the next big star, yeah, I hope they find that person soon. But if that's what he's talking about, there is nobody like that right now. But if you're talking about somebody the fans can get behind and who they took a liking to, they have that. They still have it. So I don't know what he's talking about when he says that. So Brian now is going to feud with the Wyatt family. He's been moved back down the card for a while. Maybe he'll work his way back into the title picture in a couple of months. Who knows? Maybe he'll win the Royal Rumble. I had somebody ask me, you know, who would be your odds-on favorites right now to win the Rumble? I think Punk or Brian are two pretty safe bets, but who knows? Who knows? This may be it. Maybe this is the end of the road for him as far as contending for the championship is concerned. You know, maybe they'll finally build to a match instead with Triple H, and he'll beat Triple H as revenge for the way that he's been treated. But for now, he's out of the title picture and back down the card. He got laid out by the Wyatts backstage and sent to the hospital. Bray Wyatt said, "The devil made me do it." He said the same thing later in the show when they attacked CM Punk. It's funny, one of our listeners, Jason, pointed out that Punk appears to be taking out members of the old Nexus factions. And he's right. First it was Curtis Axel and Ryback. Now it looks like Bray Wyatt. He's like a Nexus hitman. If I'm Daniel Bryan, I'd watch my back around that guy. I don't know if I'd trust him. As far as who this devil is that Wyatt kept referring to, my first thought was Vince McMahon. But that makes no sense if he's coming back as a babyface. So maybe Heyman? You know, Paul Heyman was off the show. He was selling his injuries from Hell in a Cell. But they did take out Punk, and Punk's been feuding with Heyman. Maybe it's the Wyatts and one of Heyman's guys against Punk and Bryan and two partners at Survivor Series. That seems to be the rumored match. I could see Kane also, which would make no sense, given that Kane was last feuding with the Wyatts, and he even took out Harper and Rowan at the pay-per-view. So that makes me think Heyman may have something to do with it. As far as partners for Punk and Bryan at Survivor Series, maybe the Rhodes brothers, or maybe some combination of Miz and Big E Langston. I guess we'll see. For Bryan, it's a step down. You know, there's no other way around it. For the Wyatts, it's their biggest program yet. You know, they have a chance to work with two top guys and elevate their game. If Punk and Bryan can help get them over as bigger stars in the eyes of the fans, then it's a plus for the Wyatt family. They obviously see big things in them. They've invested a lot. They have the big, fancy, elaborate entrance still with the lantern and everything. And Bray Wyatt has not exactly lit the world on fire thus far in his WWE tenure. He's hurt now. I don't know that he can't wrestle, but he did suffer that injury, I think it was like a bruised calf or something a few weeks ago. I mean, the guy's debut match was against Kane in a Ring of Fire at SummerSlam. You're limiting what the guy is capable of. I felt bad for him going into that first match. How good of a match can you expect him to have against Kane with fire surrounding the ring where you can't even hit the ring ropes? So he had a really bad match at SummerSlam when he made his debut. He's had better matches since, but not that real big breakout performance. And I think if he's going to feud with Punk and he's going to feud with Bryan, then it's the best shot they have, I think, for the Wyatts. So hopefully they take advantage of it. Punk beat Ryback on this show for the third time in a row. Fans got to choose the stipulation. They voted for a street fight. For those of you who have asked me, there is no difference between a street fight and a no DQ match. They are the same thing. In a street fight, you're supposed to come dressed in street clothes, and nobody does that anymore. I think the last time I remember somebody doing that actually might have been last year at Extreme Rules when Chris Jericho and CM Punk had that street fight. I think they came dressed in street clothes. They've had plenty of street fights on TV, and everyone just wrestles in their gear like it's just another match. You know, they'll bring in a chair, a kendo stick to make it, you know, hardcore. Wrestling street fights these days are extremely lame. Younger fans have no concept of what a real street fight should look like. It's so sad. Anyway, Punk delivered a top rope elbow to Ryback through the table and then tapped him out in the middle of the ring with the Anaconda Vice. It was quick and to the point, exactly what their pay-per-view match should have been, and that was the match inside the cell. And it was boring and pointless. This is what that match should have been, and we got this one for free on TV. This also felt like the real blow-off to the feud and the end of Ryback as any sort of meaningful character. Say it with me, people. Ryback is dead. He's been dead for most of the year. It just took him this long to finally lay down. They did nothing at the pay-per-view or on the show to convince me that Ryback has any value left at all. So that's the end of Ryback. Afterwards, the Wyatts attacked Punk. I talked about that already. The Miz wrestled Kane on this show. That's not really true. Kane just destroyed him with a chokeslam and pinned him. Did Miz even get in any offense? I don't think he did. This was a total 1980 squash match here. Miz got beat up by the Wyatts at Hell in a Cell. Kane came out for the save and ended up laying Miz out with a chokeslam. Miz limps down to the ring with a puss on his face for this match and just gets laid out again and pinned. That's about all the dude is good for these days. So long as they insist on keeping him a babyface, he will continue to get shit on and nobody will care. And to be fair, even if they turn him heel at this point, I still won't care. They've got some work to do if they want to repair this guy, and I don't think they care enough to invest the time they would need to repair this guy. But somebody did ask me a question about The Miz in the mailbag. I do have an idea on what they could do with him, so I'll get to that later on. After the match, Kane called out Stephanie McMahon, and at the risk of sounding sexist, I'm sorry, but Stephanie McMahon's breasts on this show, good God. She certainly raised my awareness, and she didn't even have to wear pink to do it. Kane said that she has abused her power, but it's what's best for business. The monster is yours to unleash, he said, before walking up the ramp, ripping off his mask and wig, and handing it to her. And then she held it up high, like Sub-Zero in Mortal Kombat when he holds up his opponent's spine like a trophy. I'm sad to see Kane unmask again. I'm not a big fan of Uncle Fester Kane. Plus, the poor guy had grown his hair back out to a decent length, and now he had to go back and shave it all off again, so that sucks. You know, he's getting up there in years. He ain't getting any younger. He's not going to be able to grow his hair out like that much longer, but I know why they did it. He's got a movie coming out in a few months where he's going to be unmasked, so it wouldn't exactly make much sense to keep the mask on him on TV. It also means that Kane has once again turned heel. I believe he's now overtaken Big Show 24 turns to Big Show's 23. But those are just my own rough estimates of how many times both these guys have turned over the course of their careers. It also marks the return of Corporate Kane. Remember when he was in the corporation, he was a reluctant member, and they would always make fun of him and mock the poor guy? I think this sets up an obvious opponent for Daniel Bryan after the Wyatt stuff runs its course. We had two Divas matches on this show. AJ and Tamina beat the Bellas when AJ tapped out Nikki in her Black Widow. I forgot to clock it on the stopwatch. I did clock the second match, though. 5 minutes, 2 seconds with Natalya beating Summer Rae in Summer's debut singles match on Raw. I thought Summer was very impressive here. Natalya won with the sharpshooter, but this match was all Summer Rae. She kicked Natalya's ass for most of those 5 minutes and really only lost because she got distracted by a brawl that erupted outside the ring with Fandango, Hornswoggle, and Kali. Talk about a trio. I watch her, and, you know, she's the kind of diva who I think will only get better with time. I don't want to say she's the next Trish Stratus or anything, but I think that she has the potential to show that kind of improvement if they can just get her more ring time. She gets it on NXT. Those people who watch NXT know that she wrestles quite a bit, actually, on that show, but she needs it on the main shows, too. Hopefully we'll see more of her, because I think they got something there. Real Americans beat the Rhodes Boys after Swagger made Goldust tap out to the ankle lock. Real Americans are getting over a bit more each week. I dig their new entrance, too, where they toss the flags into the ring. Cesaro had this look of just absolute shock and joy on his face when he realized that his team had won the match. Like, he couldn't believe it. The win should put them in line for a tag title shot at some point. Who knows when? I mean, it took the Usos a while to get their match. The main event segment, they once again had the entire locker room all come out onto the stage like a bunch of little lapdogs. Out came Triple H, Stephanie, Randy Orton. And by the way, Curtis Axel was also on stage. He was dressed up in his gear. He had the Intercontinental title around his waist. He's still hurt, though. He didn't wrestle on the show, but he was there, so he can't be that hurt. So out comes the Authority. Out comes Randy Orton, the new WWE champion. And I mentioned earlier, they embrace at one point. Roman Reigns in the background has this disgusted look on his face. Randy Orton talked, blah, blah, blah. He said something. I don't remember what it was. All you need to know is that the Big Show, the fired Big Show, came out. His music hit, too. He came out, and he was barred from the building. So all these things, and yet here comes Big Show, and he runs through the Shield, the Usos, and Goldust and Cody come down to assist, and everyone's beating up the Shield, which leaves a clear path for Big Show now to enter the ring, and the heels, they all clear out in fear. Big Show grabs a microphone, talks about having Triple H arrest me, and, you know, my lawsuit's going to bankrupt this company. Yeah, I forgot to mention, he's now suing WWE. He's suing the company, because if there's one thing the fans care about, it's wrestlers filing lawsuits against each other. How exciting. So Randy Orton sneaks up, he nails Big Show with the championship belt. Big Show recovers, he knocks out Orton with one punch. Orton just looks like a complete goofball. And he's the face of the company now, right? They want us to believe. So he's laid out. Triple H is on the outside of the ring. He and Big Show are having a stare down. Show is just burning a hole through this guy inside the ring, just waiting, begging for him to come in. And Triple H teases it. You know, he's going to go in. Then he changes his mind. He goes back out. And I have to say, and by the way, this all happens. Show goes off the air like this. Daniel Bryan off in a hospital bed somewhere, never to be heard from again. I will say the fans were into this. People were really into the Big Show. They seemed to be really excited about seeing a Big Show Triple H match. At least the people in the building on this night in Orlando were excited. And that's how they went off the air. So there are people who want to see the match. They've done a very good job of making the Big Show mean more than he has in years. The Big Show is more relevant now with this angle than he has been in a long, long time. But it makes you wonder, all along, was that really the plan? Was the idea really ever to push Daniel Bryan as their top guy? Maybe if that SummerSlam number came in and it was a huge number, maybe that would have changed their minds. You know, sometimes it's hard to argue. They're running a business. They tried something new. They weren't pleased with the numbers. And they pulled the plug. And I think that that's a little too reactionary. I think you need to give it time. It's not going to happen overnight. You've got to convince people that this guy is worth paying for. They've done a piss-poor job of giving people a reason to want to see Daniel Bryan to the point where they'll part with their money, especially after the crappy pay-per-view finishes they've given us in the last couple of shows, and in particular that Battleground atrocity, which we shall never speak of again. So it's weird, you know, the way they've booked things. They've certainly taken a different approach with the Mighty Big Show. They have booked him strong all the way through, ever since the crying ended. Even Big Show is not immune to bad booking. They went a little overboard, I think, on the Big Show crying stuff. It got to a point where it's like, okay, enough of this already. But they've turned it around, and Big Show is the biggest babyface in the company. And now we're heading into Survivor Series, and I'm not quite sure what match we're going to get. The teases are all for Big Show Triple H. I'm sure that match is going to happen at some point. Survivor Series would seem like the most logical place to do it. Thing is, if you do that, what does Randy Orton do? You got to have Randy Orton defend the title on Survivor Series. It's one of your biggest pay-per-views of the year. If it was some random B-show, I'd almost be okay with Orton taking a break for 1 month, but you got to have him defend it at Survivor Series. I don't really see there being an opening for him in any of the if they're going to do elimination matches. So who else is there for him to defend the title against? It's not going to be Punk. It's not going to be Bryan. It's not going to be Cena. Who else is there? They're not going to do a three-way, I don't think, with Orton, Triple H, and Big Show, or a handicap match. I don't need to see that. So it looks like Big Show, Triple H, is going to be your main event for Survivor Series. Could very well be the match that ends the pay-per-view. You know, good for them. I'm glad some people are into the storyline. I like Big Show. I think Big Show is great in his role. I think Big Show's been fantastic. I just can't say that Triple H versus the Big Show as your main headline program on Raw really does much for me. They also made the announcement on WWE.com during the week. Triple H did a sit-down interview with Michael Cole. And the big news is that the Big Show has been banned for life from WWE, which basically means he'll be back on TV this Monday. If they can control themselves, maybe the following Monday. Maybe I'll give them a week. Maybe they could actually keep Big Show off TV for a week. I don't even think they could do that. Chris Jericho made an appearance on the Busted Open radio show this past week, and he had some interesting comments in response to Triple H's comments in that promo on Raw 2 weeks ago when he singled out RVD, Edge, and Jericho as, you know, good wrestlers who were never the guys. They never drew all this garbage. And Jericho had gone on Twitter and said, you know, well, this is funny coming from Triple H, a guy who himself was never the guy, and, you know, bye-bye WWE, I'm moving on, and then he took some of those tweets down. So, in the interview here, he admitted that he was basically loaded when he made those comments. He said, the funny thing was, had I not been drinking Grey Goose vodka and not been completely loaded when I heard about it, I wouldn't have even bothered tweeting about it. But I was like, screw him, I'm going to tweet back. But that's Triple H being Triple H. It's just the way he is, and whether he believes it or not, it's part of the show. It's funny, throughout our careers, Triple H and I were almost at the same level. We were always the guy that worked with the guy. Triple H is a huge star, one of the greatest of all time, but also never really the guy. Who really has been the guy over the last 10 years? I could think of three: Rock, Stone Cold, and John Cena. There you go. So that's from Chris Jericho, and I'm so happy he said that, because there are a group, granted a small group, but a group of, shall we call them, Triple H's biggest fans. I'll be nice, and I'll call them his biggest fans, who heard me use that line about how he was always the guy who worked with the guy who made money, and how I would credit that line to Jim Cornette. You know, he's the one I first heard it from. And I guess, you know, you mention the name Jim Cornette, you're automatically some you know, geek who sits around watching Cornette shoot interviews all day. Well, can't say that anymore. And I agree with him, by the way, on Austin, Rock, and Cena being the guys at different points over the last, you know, Jericho said 10 years, I'd say over the last 15 years. Before that, it was Bret Hart, then Shawn Michaels. It's a very short list, if you think about it. Before Bret, it was Hogan. Before Hogan, it was Bruno. That's it. Those are the guys that are identified with each era in WWE history. There were a lot of other top stars, you know, Triple H, Undertaker. Undertaker was never really the guy, I don't think. Even when he was the champion on top, he was never that one guy who kind of carried the company, and you would think without him, you know, what do they do? You know, they built an entire new generation era around Bret. Shawn, when he, you know, beat Bret, Bret left for a while, and Shawn was the guy, so, you know, he was the guy. After Shawn, it was Austin, and then Rock, and then Cena. I agree with him 100% on that. There aren't that many of those kinds of guys, and Triple H certainly is not among them. That doesn't mean I'm Triple H bashing, but much like the TNA diehards, I guess if you say anything negative about something they like or a person they like, they get very upset about that. And all I'm going to say to that is, good. I like it. I like it when people get upset. It's good to have an emotional response to something. If you're pissed off about that, good. That puts a smile on my face. Let's talk about NXT here. I did not review NXT last week, but I have been keeping up with the show. I have not missed an episode yet. This is the second week in a row that we've gotten a shorter show, about 40 minutes this week, but Tyler Breeze is in the main event, so I can excuse that. Show opened with Alexander Rusev and Sylvester Lefort in Lefort's first match on NXT. He is, in fact, a wrestler, not just a manager. You never know it if you just watched him on this show. I think he was trained by Lance Storm, actually, so he does wrestle. This is his first match. They were going up against Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. Alexander Rusev just beat the crap out of everybody, including his own partner slash manager. He beat up Lefort, he beat up Enzo Amore, he beat up Colin Cassidy. This dude is an absolute beast. He won with the camel clutch on Cassidy. An unidentified blonde woman showed up on top of the ramp at the end there, and she was the same one who circled the ring last week during Alexander Rusev's match. She just came out in the middle of the match, walked around the ring, and walked off, and they never did bother telling us. I don't even know if the announcers even acknowledged her. So this was her second appearance here. This time, Rusev walked up the ramp, and they left together. So the plot thickens, I guess. Aiden English beat Jason Jordan. The people are still loving English's entrance, and they even demand an encore after the match, even though he's a heel. And now they have people throwing roses at him in the ring, which I think is a nice touch. I also notice he's now referring to himself as the drama queen. I don't know about a guy referring to himself as any sort of queen, but whatever works. We got a WWE.com video from last week catching up with Adrian Neville in the back after Corey Graves, his violent attack on Neville's knee. And he cut a short promo vowing to get back at Corey Graves and said things between them are only first getting started. It was okay. You know, his promos are not the strongest. It's really his in-ring work that sets him apart from everybody else. He's an amazing worker. I mean, the stuff he can do in the ring is unbelievable. But as far as his speaking ability and promos and all that, he's okay. I wouldn't really go much further than that. Paige against Summer Rae. I had a big problem with this match, and it had nothing to do at all with the women. I thought they had a good match. Sasha Banks was out there with Summer and got involved, so the referee ended up banishing her to the back. I'm really digging Summer Rae as a wrestler. Like I said earlier in the Raw review, she's good. You know, I wouldn't say she's great yet, but maybe the bar has just been set so low with these Divas matches that, you know, it makes her look better than she really is. But I really do think she's getting better. Paige is already great. She won with her Paige Turner finish, which kind of came out of nowhere. 1-2-3. After the match, Sasha ran back out to attack Paige. That brought down Emma for the save. She's beating down Sasha Banks in the corner. Paige just casually walks over, puts her hand on Emma's shoulder as if to tell her, you know, it's okay, you can stop kicking this girl's ass now. And Emma, maybe thinking that it was Summer Rae, turns around and nails Paige with a hard shot. That's how I interpreted it anyway, that it was not done on purpose, or was it? I don't know. It reminded me of that Saturday night's main event episode where Hogan and Warrior teamed up against Perfect and the Genius, and Warrior is just throwing clotheslines left and right, knocking down Perfect, knocking down Genius, and Hogan, in his infinite wisdom, says to himself, hey, maybe I should step into this madman's path and try to calm him down, and he ends up getting walloped. And then, of course, they play up the dissension between the two afterwards. That's exactly what happened here. They're kind of friends, but not really. It's clearly the biggest women's match they could do right now on NXT, and it looks like it's coming sooner rather than later. But back to the problem I mentioned at the beginning here. They inserted a Raw Rebound video right in the middle of this match that felt like it would never end, okay? I see enough of Big Show and Triple H on Raw. The last fucking thing I need is another 5 minutes of them on this show. Right in the middle of a match, no less. It was after a short break. So they actually took like a short commercial break, and instead of going back to the match, I then have to sit through highlights of the crap that I already saw on Monday. NXT has largely been devoid of this type of stuff in the time that I've been watching the show anyway. Maybe I've just been spoiled because I don't have to deal with commercials on this show the way that I do with the main shows. But these shows are getting shorter and shorter. Like I said, only 40 minutes this week. And part of that was this video recap. I really hope they don't start poisoning this show with that, because one of the reasons I like it so much is that it's not Raw. That's not why I watch NXT. So for some reason, that just really pissed me off when I saw that. I'm watching this going, what the fuck happened to the match? Why am I watching a highlight video that I'm going to see this Monday anyway? It's going to be the same fucking video that I see when Raw goes on the air Monday night. Why is this in the middle of this match? I hope that this is not going to become a regular thing now on this show. Tyler Breeze was backstage with the dreadlocks that he had cut from CJ Parker's scalp last week. And he says he's about to go out there to shoot the breeze. This guy's great. They aired a promo for Luke Harper, hyping his match next week with Cassius Ohno. He called him his new plaything. Their first match a few weeks ago, Harper won, so I would think that Ohno would win this time, especially since Luke Harper isn't really even on NXT anymore, and Cassius Ohno is, but Cassius Ohno is not the one getting the push, so I don't know what they're planning on doing there. CJ Parker beat Tyler Breeze in the main event with his moonshot palm thrust to the face. I really just don't like CJ Parker. I think his gimmick sucks. The crowd was totally behind Breeze in this match, just like they were behind Aiden English. The NXT crowd is very smarky. It's a very smarky crowd, which can be very entertaining, but it can also be very distracting. Like, they're just out there to cheer for whoever WWE doesn't want them to cheer for. In any event, Parker wins. He grabs a pair of scissors. He starts threatening to cut off part of Tyler Breeze's hair. The crowd starts a loud chant of no, no, no. Breeze escapes. People cheer. And the episode ends with CJ Parker dancing in the ring. I don't even know if you could really call that dancing. He was just gyrating his hips like an idiot and getting no reaction from the crowd. I mean, nothing at all. Crickets to this guy. But still, a fun episode. A short one. Feels like it's lacking a little something with no Bo Dallas or Sami Zayn. That's the main title feud. And they haven't even been on the show, I think, the last 2 weeks now. I think they were on the tour with the main roster that was going on when they did these tapings, so we probably have another week or two without them. And then at that point, they should be back, and hopefully things will pick up a little bit more. Impact Wrestling has been in the news quite a bit this week. A lot of stories going around about the future of TNA. Is the company going to be sold? Are they up for sale? All of these things started. There was a report that originated with Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer. That's what got this whole wave of stories going. And he talked about there being some very serious discussions going on behind the scenes, and that there was at least one potential buyer that has been looking at buying either into the company or maybe just buying the company outright. There have been meetings that have gone on in Nashville. Viacom is not interested in buying TNA, which is kind of surprising. TNA actually does some of the better ratings they do on that network. You would think there would be some level of interest on their part in buying the company. That does not appear to be the case. And Dave said in his report that the parties involved currently come from outside the pro wrestling industry. It's not, you know, necessarily Eric Bischoff or somebody like that. Apparently it's not. And on Friday, in response to all of these reports of about a potential sale, Janice Carter, Dixie's mom, who has been handling many of the company's financial matters for a while now, she issued an internal memo to company employees that got leaked. And in that memo, she says, any rumors that Panda Energy is attempting to sell its ownership stake in TNA is false, and that she remains committed to the company. Well, I mean, really, what else is she going to say at the end of the day? I suppose she just could have said nothing and kept her mouth shut, but I really wouldn't expect any other sort of response from her or anybody else in the company. Now, originally, it was the report from Meltzer. Then I saw that Jason Powell over at ProWrestling.net, which is, again, one of those reputable sources that I would recommend checking out. There are certain websites that are more accurate than others when it comes to stuff like this, and I would put, you know, Meltzer and Powell in that category. So Powell comes out with a report of his own saying that there is a party interested in buying TNA that fans would know and who has money behind them. So I absolutely believe that the TNA folks have met with or have spoken with people who are interested in buying at least a stake in the company, be it a majority stake or otherwise. I don't believe for a second that TNA is not up for sale. I'm not saying they've got an ad on Craigslist saying, hey, we're for sale. But if somebody comes along and says, hey, listen, I want to talk to you about either investing in the company or a potential sale, they'd be idiots not to at least hear them out. So I absolutely believe that that's going on. Lou DeAngeli, who original fans of ECW may remember as Sign Guy Dudley. He also had a stint in WWE. He worked in the front office there for a while. I think now he worked for Cirque du Soleil doing marketing or something. But anyway, he posted on his Twitter this weekend that Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins was in Nashville, Tennessee this past week inquiring about buying TNA. Apparently, he is very good friends with Billy Corgan. And Lou wrote, quote, I know he's pretty serious in at least partial, if not majority, ownership, end quote. Billy Corgan has been a wrestling fan for his entire life. He made a few appearances in the original ECW way back in the day. He's run independent shows. There's a promotion called Resistance Pro Wrestling that he either had. I think he still may have an involvement with them. I think they have a show coming up, actually, in a few weeks. So Corgan is like a diehard wrestling fan, and he's had involvement with wrestling and with people in wrestling now for a number of years. And I wonder if that might be the person that Jason Powell in his report was referring to. I can't imagine that anybody would buy the company without at least getting a majority stake in the decision-making process, like 51-49 or something like that. All I know is this. Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff are gone. They are gone from TNA. Bischoff may technically still be under contract, but by all accounts, Hogan certainly is still gone. Bischoff has both feet basically out the door. They're gone. And that alone is a step in the right direction. They've done nothing for that company. Bischoff probably more so than Hogan. At least Bischoff, you know, from a production standpoint, there were certain, you know, little things I'm sure that he did, and you know, the rampway to the ring, that just reeks of being a Bischoff idea, just because that goes back to the WCW days. But really, when you look at the big picture, what did they do for TNA? They did dick for that company. So I say, adios. So that's a plus for the company. And I enjoyed Impact a lot this week. I was their Halloween show. Dixie Carter came to the ring dressed like a wrestling promoter. She announced an 8-man tournament to crown a new TNA World Heavyweight Champion since AJ Styles walked out with the belt. The idea is that AJ is going to be off TV for a while, defending his title in other promotions, which, as I talked about last week on the Sound Off, that's the one thing TNA can try to do with this storyline that WWE absolutely refused to do. They should have let Punk go defend that belt in Japan or something, and aired footage of it on their TV show, or you know, put footage on the website if you want to do it like a guerrilla type of thing, and don't air it on TV, but air it on .com or something. There's so many things they could have done, but they didn't. TNA at least has the chance to actually do that, albeit on a much smaller scale. AJ is defending the TNA title against Judas Macias at today's AAA tapings, the TV taping in Mexico. He may also be defending it at the Wrestle One show in Japan on November 16th. So, again, at least that's one aspect of the angle they can pull off better than the other company. So, the tournament starts this week. She announced James Storm, Samoa Joe, Kurt Angle, Jeff Hardy, Austin Aries, Bobby Roode, and Chris Sabin with the eighth spot to be determined in a Royal Rumble later on in the night. They call it a gauntlet. I'm not really sure why they do, because it's not a gauntlet. Bully Ray came out. He was very upset over not being included in the tournament. Dixie said, listen, you lost twice to AJ, and you caused this whole mess to begin with. Not to mention, the guy turned his back on the company and terrorized the entire roster with a hammer for most of the year. I tell the dude to go screw. Mr. Anderson came out. He brawled with Bully to end the segment. When he came back, we saw Anderson backstage being jumped by Bully, beaten with a chain backstage. The Bromans beat James Storm and Gunner to retain their tag team titles after using they used the Rick Rude Ultimate Warrior finish here from WrestleMania 5, with Robbie E playing the role of Bobby Heenan, holding Storm's foot on the outside as Storm tried to suplex Jesse Godders back into the ring. Jesse fell on top of him. Storm couldn't kick out, and so he got pinned. This man is in the world title tournament, by the way. I don't like his chances. Dixie met with Sting backstage. She killed off that pesky little stipulation that Sting could never again challenge for the world title by saying she was going to lift it for one night only and put him in the gauntlet match. Sting did not seem to really care. He seemed more upset than anything else, and he walked away without giving her an answer. So even Sting is pissed they can't honor their own stipulations. Ethan Carter III beat Norv Furnum, the same jobber he beat at Bound for Glory. He used his Bulldog DDT finisher. Not much to it. EC3's got some really awkward facial expressions whenever he plays to the camera. I think he needs to work on that. Magnus won a 7-man Royal Rumble to earn the final spot in the title tournament. He's my pick, by the way, to win the whole thing. Sting and Kazarian started the match. The crowd chanted, "You still got it," at Sting, which got this great reaction from Taz.
Sting get hung up in the Vigo with these people saying, "You still got it," that stupid-ass chant.
It really is stupid the way people throw that chant around. Sting's on TV every week and probably wrestles every other week. Is it really necessary to chant that every time he wrestles? Gauntlet also included Christopher Daniels, Manic, Eric Young, and Nux of Aces and Eights. And this was priceless. So Nux is eliminated by Manic. Okay, he gets dumped to the floor on a Hurricanrana, and Taz is just beside himself with frustration. He just loses it and gives us yet another gem on commentary.
We can't get a break with Aces and Eights. I gotta get rid of this fast. I gotta get out of this club. This club sucks.
This club sucks. Yes, even Taz finally admits what we've already known for a year now. Aces and Eights sucks. This is a sitting member of Aces and Eights out there on TV admitting the whole thing sucks. So how does that work now? Does Bully Ray confront him on TV this week? Of course not. It'll all be forgotten about, I'm sure. But boy, am I glad to see this thing finally die a death. Aces and Eights was an Eric Bischoff idea, which you can tell, by the way, with the way they had Taz just completely bury it on television. But it was a Bischoff idea that merged two of his favorite things in the whole wide world, motorcycles and heel factions. You know, first it was the NWO, and they used to have those Road Wild pay-per-views from Sturgis. I think Bischoff even rode his Harley or whatever it was to Sturgis himself. Now it's Aces and Eights. The man has one good creative idea and is so creatively bankrupt. Almost 20 years later, he's still going back to that well. Magnus dumped Sting and Kazarian out of the ring at the same time, and Sting was shocked. But he shouldn't be, because it's every man for himself. You got a shot at the world title on the line. Like Bobby Heenan once said, I'd throw my grandmother out of the ring to get it. Gently, of course, but I'd still throw her out. Backstage, Kurt Angle said the doctor had advised him to take the night off, but he is now medically cleared to compete, and so he was going to kick Bobby Roode's ass in the main event tonight. Oh, Kurt. Every doctor's nightmare patient, Kurt Angle. Gail Kim beat ODB to retain her knockouts title with an assist from Tamina Snuka. I mean, Lady Tapa. Bad Influence, who were great on this show. They were dressed up as Sherlock Holmes and Watson for Halloween. Besides the gauntlet, they spend most of the show searching for the monster Abyss, who made his return to TNA at Bound for Glory. Still no sign of the television title. Eric Young confronted them. He was out there in a tracksuit dressed up like Joseph Park. Abyss eventually came out. His first appearance on Impact in many, many months. He gave them both black hole slams and then helped Eric Young to his feet. I think it's time to pay off this storyline already. I love Joe Park. I really do. But whatever they're going to do here, whatever they're getting to, just get to it already. It's been a year and a half at this point. Backstage, Jeff Hardy and Chris Sabin, who meet in the first round of the title tournament this week, joined Dixie Carter, who said they would spin the wheel of Dixie to determine the stipulation for their match. I'm not going to make another joke about them borrowing a WWE idea, because really, it was a WCW idea from Halloween Havoc back in the day. Spin the wheel, make the deal. It landed on Full Metal Mayhem, which is their version of a TLC match, and they played it up as being Jeff Hardy's specialty, which I predict means that Sabin is winning. I don't like this whole idea of every tournament match needing a stipulation. I just don't think it's necessary. Main event was an excellent match between Kurt Angle and Bobby Roode in a rematch from Bound for Glory. Both these guys are great. Worth going out of your way to see. I think if you can spare 15 minutes and check this one out. There was a spot late in the match where Kurt gave Roode a belly-to-belly suplex off the top rope. Both men landed hard. Roode got up at a count of 7, but Kurt could not. In fact, Kurt was laying there shaking and twitching. And the referee finally made the wise move of stopping the match, so Bobby Roode won by ref stoppage. They played this up like a major injury angle. Kurt had this glazed-over look on his face laying there on the mat. But it's always hard to tell how much of that is an act, because Kurt always has a glazed-over expression on his face like he's not all there. This is all part of the story they're telling with Kurt declining his Hall of Fame invitation and now suffering all of these injuries. It's all going to be part of this road to redemption they're doing with him. After the match, they posted a video on their YouTube channel showing Kurt being assisted to the back and the doctor is trying to ask him all these questions. I posted a link to it on my Twitter if you want to go watch it, at Solomonster. It's really scary, like the best acting job Kurt Angle has ever done in his entire life, but it's absolutely terrifying because I can believe that the Kurt Angle you see in this video is the Kurt Angle people have probably seen for real backstage after big matches in the past. I remember reading that Angle was standing there like naked and in shock backstage after his WrestleMania 19 match with Brock Lesnar. He wasn't naked here, thank God, but he did a great job of acting like somebody who legit didn't know where he was and probably suffered about as bad of a concussion as you could possibly get. He looks at referee Brian Hebner and just kind of mutters, "Oh, hey, Brian." You know, he's got no recollection of the match he just had. They ask him, "Do you know who you were in the ring with?" And he couldn't even remember. They explain what happened. He goes, "Yeah, I wrestled Bobby at Bound for Glory." And Hebner's like, "No, Kurt, you also wrestled him tonight." And Angle started drooling all over himself. For what it was supposed to be, I thought it was very well done, very well executed. And they've got me interested to see where they go with it next, how far they're willing to take it. So I say thumbs up on Impact this week. It's time for the mailbag. If you have questions to email me, please send them to thesolomonster@gmail.com. I'm still accepting audio questions as well. We didn't get any this week, but you could email them to me as an attachment in MP3 format only. Try to keep it brief if you can, and also include the text of your question in the body of the email in case I can't understand the audio for some reason. Matthew Davis wrote in, this is to follow up on the story from last week's Sound Off about WWE reportedly denying Yoshitatsu's request to move from Florida to Texas to live in a community with other Japanese people. Matthew says, "I just wanted to tell you there is a large population of Japanese residents in Houston, Texas. I work there in the tech industry, and many Japanese companies are located there. Much of the Japanese population there came to Houston during World War II. So that gives us a little more perspective on that story. Poor Yoshi. Just do what makes you happy, dude.
This book sucks!
Albert writes in, "Cena is the face of WWE, but in TNA, who in your opinion is the face of their company?" It's got to be AJ Styles, I think, without question. He's been there since day one. He's been their top guy. He's been champion. He's been in the middle of the card and back up to the top again. You know, he's the guy most closely associated with TNA, which is why I think they have to work extra hard to keep him when his contract is up at the end of the year and make sure he doesn't leave. Even if he doesn't go to WWE, and you know, reports seem to indicate that WWE doesn't even have any interest in him. They don't have any interest in Matt Morgan. He doesn't have to go to WWE for it to be a big blow to the company. If he leaves, that would look very bad for TNA because I associate him as the face of the company. Behind him, I would say Kurt Angle. Kurt's been more of the face of TNA than he ever was in WWE. You know, when he was in WWE, he was never the face of that company. Now he has spent more total years in TNA than he had in WWE. And for at least a period there, you could say that he was the face of the company. You know, he's also a five-time TNA champion, always has excellent matches. He's worked with just about everybody of any note on that roster. So I'd put AJ first and then Kurt right behind him.
This club sucks!
Kenny Givens from Cincinnati, Ohio. In case you haven't noticed, The Miz has been getting owned by everybody lately. Oh, believe me, I've noticed. He never ruffled any feathers before that I know of, so I don't know that this is a burial. I'm wondering, what the hell is this supposed to be? If he does turn heel, do you think he should be a psychopath type of character? No. No, absolutely not. I will never buy into Miz as a psychopath or any sort of serious threat. I just can't. You know, you want to know what role I think Miz should be part of, and this goes to what I was talking about during the Raw review. I said somebody wrote into the mailbag, I had an idea that I think would be good for The Miz, okay? Because, you know, Miz is there. They like him. He's a good representative of the company. They have him doing a lot of, you know, PR work and go traveling to Russia to do PR for the company and all this stuff. He's valuable to them in that regard. It's just that his on-air character sucks, and I have no interest in seeing him wrestle. I have no interest in seeing him speak. Part of that is just him, and part of that is that the company certainly hasn't really, they haven't exactly done much with him. As far as the role that I think he'd be perfect for, he comes off as a corporate suck-up. Okay, whenever he does interviews or he does commentary on one of the shows, he's just way too polished, he's too robotic, he's got the corporate pull string in his back. I think he should go heel, I think that goes without saying, go heel, and he'd be the perfect fit as Triple H and Stephanie's ass-kissing lackey in The Authority. I think he'd be great in like the Brad Maddox type of role. I'm not saying he should be the GM of Raw, but just he comes out with them in the Shield wearing his nice suit, stands in the background with this cheesy grin on his face, just ready to do their bidding at a moment's notice. You know, you got some bad news to deliver to one of the baby faces? I guess you could use Bad News Barrett, but if you don't, you know, let's say you got a baby face who's going to be in a handicap match tonight, right? Got some bad news for them? Great. Send Miz to their locker room and let them know. He's just so easy to hate. That's why Kane chokeslammed him in Hell in a Cell, and it got a bigger pop than Kane attacking the Wyatts did. Well, now he can stand with Kane as an ally of the Authority, and he can play up the role of corporate ass-kisser, which is how I already look at him anyway. At least then he can get some heel heat for it.
This club sucks!
Tommy writes in, with Mickie James now a free agent, could you see her back in WWE in a potential match with AJ Lee at WrestleMania 30? I know most fans want it to be Natty and AJ, but I feel if booked right, Mickie AJ could actually be a Divas title match that fans can care about. Most fans want it to be AJ and Natty, really. Who are these fans you speak of? Because I'm not really all that interested in that match. They've done nothing with Natty Neidhart lately. She's back to dancing with Kali. She beat Summer Rae on Raw this week after getting her ass kicked for most of the match. I'd be down for an AJ Mickey match. I don't see it. WWE has not touched. They have not touched anybody from TNA. I'm trying to think of the last really recent guy or girl from TNA that WWE has signed. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head. They've got plenty of younger divas that they've trained through their own system at NXT. They've got Paige. They've got Emma. They've got Summer Rae. Charlotte, who's Ric Flair's daughter. I don't think they really have any interest in going after somebody like Tara or Mickie, especially since there were some issues with Mickie the last time that led to her release from the company, so I just don't see it.
This book sucks!
Binder from Wisconsin, why does TNA insist on bringing the Abyss gimmick back at a pay-per-view but then have no mention of him on the following Impact show? Probably because it's not like bringing Abyss back is a big deal anymore. I mean, he did show up on Impact this week on the Halloween show, the day after Binder actually sent in this question. And, you know, he beat up Bad Influence, who I love, but let's be honest here, Bad Influence, they never win a match. It's not as though he's beating up main event guys. And the TV title he won, what was it, back in June? They don't even acknowledge its existence anymore. Abyss is not that special character that he used to be. Maybe because they've kept him out for so long. Maybe they've kept him out for too long. I have no use for the Abyss character anyway. I've made that clear. Of the two, I am more entertained by him as Joe Park. They're not doing as much with the Joe Park character like they used to because the character is not as fresh. I'd love to see them just go back to that. You know, less ring time for the guy and more skits and stuff like that. I really don't say that kind of thing often, like more skits, less wrestling. But in the case of Joe Park and that character, I think you either love it or you absolutely, positively hate that character. I know some people loathe it. I'm still entertained by it. I'd much rather see him than Abyss, so I don't really care either way.
This book sucks!
Hunter Palmer in Lexington, Kentucky. I agree with what you have said on TNA in that the in-ring product can be quite good, but the storytelling is where things tend to fall apart. The other night, I found myself trying to think of a way forward for them, and I went back to something one of your other listeners said in the mailbag on an older sound-off when they tossed out the idea of baby faces and heels going away. This basically what he's saying is somebody had written in with the idea of what if a company was to do away with the notion of, you know, good guys and bad guys, heels and baby faces, and it was more just you send them out there, you know, you book matches and feuds and all that kind of stuff, but you let the crowd, you let the fans dictate who they like and who they don't. So essentially they're the ones dictating who the baby faces and the heels are. So that's what Hunter's referring to. Just letting people root for whoever they want. And he says, just giving guys broad outlines of what roles to play, but for the most part, just letting them work. The people will reward good matches, and you could book feuds based on that rather than some complex story or dumb trademark like hitting people with hammers. I know this would be a big break from the way things are normally done, but the sinking ship that is TNA just might be the right place to try it. No harm, no foul. In that respect, should TNA embrace its own minimalism? Why not? They have nothing creatively working for them right now. They don't have that one big story that's knocking it out of the park. The AJ storyline isn't, at least not yet. It's still early. Maybe it'll connect. Maybe it'll be successful. Heel Dixie isn't working. I'm not buying her shtick. Aces and Eights has been a complete failure.
This book sucks!
So really, what do they have to lose? You still need storylines. I'm not saying that they should just have a bunch of X-Division guys go out there and have Spotfest every week. But I like that idea of TNA embracing its minimalism, as you call it, instead of just trying to be WWE light, which is what they've been lately, especially with these storylines they keep ripping off from the other show. It's WWE light. They don't have to be that. You can't be WWE. I don't want them to be WWE. One WWE is enough for me. Embrace what you are and just be the best at that. Be an alternative. I agree with Hunter. I don't see anything wrong with them trying it. I mean, God knows they've tried a bunch of other things that haven't worked out. They tried going to Mondays. That didn't work out. They tried going on the road. That didn't work out. Well, here's an idea that won't cost you any money the way those two things did. It's not going to cost you millions of dollars to just change direction. So, why not?
This book sucks!
Evil Evan writes into the sound off. First, thanks for the sound off extras on YouTube. Pleasant Monday morning surprise. Now on to my question. Would you rather be the world champion of an independent promotion like an ROH or PWG, or a jobber in WWE like a Zack Ryder or Yoshitatsu? Which would you choose? 5-star caliber title matches in VFW halls, or getting squashed every night in front of thousands for a 6-digit paycheck? Me, I'd go where the money is, but that's coming from somebody who doesn't make a whole lot of it. You want to also be happy where you are. Happiness is also very important. If you're miserable and you want to kill yourself, that's not good either. You look at some of these guys, though, like a Zack Ryder and the comments he's always making on Twitter, and he just comes off as being the most miserable person in the world. I'm sure he loves what he does, but it's got to be demoralizing to somebody like that to put all that work and all that effort, you know, into his YouTube show and his character. He gets himself over with the crowd and has a little bit of success. You know, he won the U.S. title. He beat Ziggler. That was a big deal at the time, for him anyway. And just to see it all pissed away because, you know, how dare he get himself over? So it's got to be demoralizing for him. And a guy like Yoshitatsu, I don't even see his name pop up in any house show reports. And I know he's never on any of the main shows like Raw. So how often is that guy really even working? It seems like he rarely wrestles, and he's been with the company for 6 years now. He's not a rookie. He's not a new guy. So you figure after road expenses, I mean, I'm not sure a guy like that is really pulling in six figures. If he is, it's probably not much more than that. If you're working for Ring of Honor and you're a top guy, you're the world champ, I'm sure they're making decent money. I mean, it's not WWE money, but it's got to be pretty decent money. Plus, you can work other independent shows and make more money that way too. I mean, they have rules in place that say you can't be on a show that's being recorded either for DVD purposes or as an iPay-per-view. I think TNA has the same rules because more and more, a lot of TNA talents are going on their Twitter and they're putting word out that they're accepting bookings because TNA has scaled way back on house shows, at least until the early part of next year. And there's a lot of guys who get paid per appearance. If they're not making appearances, they're not getting paid. So they got to go out and work somewhere else. So they have rules in place like that. But again, you know, you're a top guy in ROH, making decent money. You can work a bunch of other indie shows during the week on your days off. And you've got a title. You're working main events. You're having great matches. If it's between that and being a jobber in WWE, not like a mid-card level guy, but a jobber, job security would be another concern of mine. Jobbers are way more expendable than guys who actually have a role on TV and storylines every week. It's not like they're just going to, I mean, not that they haven't done this before, but it's a lot more rare for, let's say, a WWE to axe somebody to get rid of them, unless they fail the wellness test or something. If they're on television every week and they're part of some ongoing storyline, they're very unlikely to just get rid of that person in the middle of that. As a jobber, what job security do you really have? No matter how good you are, you're expendable. They can get rid of you at the drop of a hat. I don't think Ring of Honor is going to let their world champion go. So you've got job security, you're making decent coin, honing your craft, getting noticed so that one day maybe you get a developmental offer to go to WWE and be more than just a jobber. Plus, you're probably having more fun that way too. So I'd probably go with being a world champion at indie promotion over being a jobber in WWE. History has been made here! Time for my favorite segment of the show. This week in wrestling history, we start 24 years ago this week on October 31st, 1989, WWE taped an episode of Saturday Night's Main Event in Topeka, Kansas, although it didn't actually air on TV until November 25th, so nearly a month later. By that point, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, who wrestled as the Brainbusters in WWE, were already gone from the company, even though they wrestled and lost to the Rockers in a 2-out-of-3 falls match on this show. Arn Anderson went back to WCW, and Tully Blanchard got himself suspended early in the month after failing a drug test for cocaine. This was, in fact, the final time he and Arn Anderson would ever wrestle together as a tag team. I had the pleasure of interviewing both men together in Miami over WrestleMania weekend last year. You can hear that as part of Sound Off 212 if you go back in the archives. And Tully talked about how they were supposed to be reunited as part of the Four Horsemen in WCW, but his own demons ruined those plans and it never happened. Also on the show, the Genius beat WWF champion Hulk Hogan by countout. Mr. Perfect stole Hogan's championship belt from ringside, took it backstage, and then took a hammer to it and smashed it into little itty-bitty pieces. 18 years ago this week, October 29, 1995, WCW Halloween Havoc at the Joe in Detroit. We had the Battle of the Monster Trucks on the roof of nearby Cobo Hall between Hulk Hogan and the Giant. This was the year that the Giant made his wrestling debut, so he was looking much younger here. Hogan won the Monster Truck Challenge after he knocked the Giant's Dungeon of Doom truck out of the circle, as per the rules of the competition. It was like a sumo wrestling match. When you knock the other guy out of the circle, you win. So then both guys get out of their trucks. The Giant is furious at this loss, and they start fighting. And Hogan ends up knocking the Giant off the roof, presumably to his death. At least that's how the announce team sold it. They kept asking, oh, which side of the building did he fall off of? Did he fall down on the parking lot, on the pavement, or did he fall into the water? Because it's like an ocean over there or something. And later on, the Giant comes walking out for his championship match with Hulk Hogan, looking none the worse for wear. Not bad for a guy who fell, God knows how many stories, presumably to his death. He looked pretty good for a dead guy. And you guys think Super Cena is bad. You ain't seen nothing until you see this. So, they have a match. Jimmy Hart, who had come over to WCW with Hulk Hogan as his babyface manager, returned to his evil roots. He turned on Hogan during the match. He hit the referee with the WCW title belt, which caused the disqualification. After the match is already over, came one of the more disturbing scenes I think that I've ever seen at a wrestling pay-per-view, where the Giant is giving Hulk Hogan a bear hug. Okay, Hogan is doomed. He is just in a heap of trouble. And the Giant has him in a bear hug. And down to the ring comes Ron Reese, wrapped in toilet paper, playing the role of this giant mummy called the Yeti. Okay, he's a Yeti. That's what he is. Well, Tony Schiavone starts going nuts. He's just completely incredulous to this whole thing. And he doesn't exactly refer to the Yeti as the Yeti. He's got his own little spin on how he refers to him.
And the Yeti! The Yeti is taller than a giant! Look at the size of the Yeti!
The Yeti! That's what he is. He's the Yeti. I always laughed my ass off whenever I would hear Schiavone refer to him as that. That's like an all-time classic clip. It's bad comedy, but it's still comedy. And what was so disturbing about it is the Yeti, as he refers to him, walks into the ring and comes up from behind Hulk Hogan and appears to be dry-humping him from behind. So you've got the Giant on one side, this 7-foot guy. You've got a guy that's even taller than the Giant, another 7-foot guy on the other side of Hogan. Hogan is being raped in the middle of the ring. It looks like he's being sexually molested by these two giants in the middle of the ring. It's a vision that even Bleach cannot remove from my eyes, unfortunately. We would find out on Nitro the next night that Jimmy Hart, who was Hogan's manager at the time, had a secret stipulation put into the contract where the title could change hands on a disqualification. So Hogan actually lost the belt. Yes, Hogan dropped the belt, but he did so on a DQ, and we didn't find out about it until 24 hours later.
You will never see a pay-per-view like this again.
Thank God for that. Also on the show, Ric Flair turned on Sting after Sting reluctantly agreed to team with Flair against Arn Anderson and Brian Pillman of the Horsemen. He had his doubts about whether or not he could trust Flair, but he did so anyway, and he was made to look like a fool. 15 years ago this week, on November 2nd, 1998, it was on Monday Night Raw that Vince McMahon created the WWF Hardcore Championship and handed it to Mankind, making him the first recognized hardcore champion. Later that same month, Mankind wrestled the Big Boss Man in Raw's first ever ladder match, and he lost the title, never to regain it again. But don't cry for the guy too much, because a month later he won the WWF title for the very first time from The Rock. So a nice little consolation prize for Mick Foley. The very next day, on November 3rd, 1998, Jesse the Body Ventura became Jesse the Governor Ventura after running as an independent candidate for governor in the state of Minnesota and shocking the world, as he said, beating Norm Coleman and Hubert Humphrey III. You know, he sounds like such a man of the people, no? Hubert Humphrey III? I can't imagine why people wouldn't vote for somebody like that. Ventura opted not to run for a second term, although I doubt he would have won, which may be why he didn't run in the first place. Now he's talking about running for president in 2016, but only if he can get Howard Stern as his running mate. That is the key. He will only do it if Howard Stern will agree to be his running mate, which is to say, Jesse's not running for president in 2016. 3 years ago this week, on November 2nd, 2010, Linda McMahon, speaking of political races, she lost in her first of two bids thus far to become senator in the state of Connecticut, losing to Richard Blumenthal. Yes, she lost to a dick. 2 years later, she would lose again, this time to Chris Murphy. And between those two races, she ended up spending a whopping $97 million with nothing to show for it. A bigger bust than the XFL. Now that's embarrassing. And finally, 2 years ago this week, on November 3rd, 2011, on an episode of TNA Impact Wrestling, Bobby Roode challenged his friend and Beer Money tag team partner James Storm for Storm's newly won TNA World title just 2 weeks after Storm won the championship from Kurt Angle. This was the match where Roode turned heel and he smashed a beer bottle over his partner's head, pinning him and winning his first and to date only TNA title. It was great watching the referee, I think it was Earl Hebner, who had been bumped, and so he didn't see the bottle shot, rolling over with like shards of glass laying all over the place in the ring, and just counting three anyway. God bless pro wrestling. Rude would go on to be the longest reigning TNA World Heavyweight Champion in company history if you ignore Jeff Jarrett's reigns with the NWA title before they dropped their NWA affiliation. If you want to include all the world title reigns since the inception of the company, then Jarrett would be the longest reigning champion at 347 days. So not quite the 434 that CM Punk had, but pretty close. And that's it for this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag or suggestions, death threats, comments, all that good stuff, email it to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything that gets to me, even if it takes me a while to get back to you. And you never know what I may use on the show. And this is a good week to email me, too, because next weekend is episode 300 of The Sound Off. It will be our six-year anniversary show. And so if you want to try to get your question on the air for episode 300, if you want to email me and share with me when you started listening to the show or for how long you've been listening to the show, what got you into the show in the first place, all that stuff, plus your questions, this would be a good week to email that to me. So, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. We're racking up followers every day. I live blog during the big events like Raw. I'll be doing that this Monday night, Impact, pay-per-views. So follow me on there. Facebook.com/thesolemonster is our official Facebook profile page. We have a separate fan page. You can like us there. And we have a closed group as well where you have to apply for membership. It's the full title of the show. Apply. I will approve you. And you can be part of our growing discussion group. A lot of good people, a lot of good debate and discussion there. So please join us there if you can. We have an official YouTube channel. I mentioned it earlier. My Hell in a Cell review from last Sunday's pay-per-view. I've got a 45-minute Triple H DVD review, a Bob Holly book review, a bunch of other stuff. And if you want to listen to the very first episodes of The Sound Off, you know, we're celebrating 6 years next weekend, and the only way for you to go back, unless you're an original listener who has them saved to your hard drive, the only way you can hear those original episodes from 2007 and 2008 is to check out our YouTube channel. Because as often as I can, I post vintage episodes of The Sound Off. And you can go back right now and listen to the very first 8 episodes of The Sound Off. All of our 2007 shows from November and December are now up on our YouTube channel. My username is TheSolemonster, all one word. Subscribe there so when new videos go up, you'll be notified. But go check out some of those old Sound Offs and check out the way I used to sound compared to the way I sound now. It's just embarrassing. And we're on Stitcher Radio. You can stream us on there for free. We're climbing the Stitcher rankings. And even if you've listened to the show already, check us out at least for a few minutes on Stitcher because it helps whenever people stream our show that way as well. We have a free app in the Google Play Store for Android devices that you can check out. And we have our Sound Off Superstore. If you want to buy a shirt, you can do so. Solemonster.spreadshirt.com. We have a whole bunch of shirts, iPhone cases. And I said it before, I'll say it again. Still, the best way to support this show is to make a direct PayPal donation. You can do that on thesolemonster.com. We're heading into 300 episodes next weekend. I still love the hell out of doing this show. I will continue doing it as long as I possibly can. But the best way you can support the show is just to contribute. I put a lot of time and work into the show every week. I wouldn't really have it any other way. It's the easiest way to support the show. And now's as good a time as any coming up on our six-year anniversary. So please do that if you've got some disposable income you'd like to send our way. And that's going to wrap up episode 299 next weekend. As I said, episode 300. I will say now that there is no grand plan for the show next weekend. I'm welcome to any suggestions and ideas, but I think to deviate from what we normally do would probably piss off a lot of people. I think people like the show as is, and I'm planning on doing a pretty much normal show, maybe with an expanded mailbag next weekend, but otherwise, it's going to be the Sound Off that you come to expect every single week. So that's going to be the big episode 300 next weekend. So don't go into it thinking that there's going to be too much in the way of pomp and circumstance unless I come up with some grand idea this week. But that is next weekend. I'm looking forward to that a lot. So please join me, and please get other people to join in as well. Any new fans you can bring into the show, certainly appreciate it. I can't say that I'm going to give you a finder's fee for that, but I'll certainly give you a thank you. Hopefully that's enough. So, until then, be well, stay safe. We'll see you back here for the big show next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solemonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Daniel Bryan's been unstoppable!
the Bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And The Ugly.
Hello.
Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? What the fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-Fab you.
You're going to K-Fab me?
Salamonster sounds off.
Since 2007 on thesalamonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, The Salamonster Sounds Off.